over last week that I kind of wanted to speak about that I didn't really bring out. So if you don't mind, I'm going to step back a little bit and then we'll catch up, because I just find these couple things to be kind of important going forward, that we always kind of take it for granted that, and again, I have to go back to Genesis 3, and I think that's the crux of the Bible, is I will make enmity between your seed and his seed. And it's all about, we know the Messiah is the seed of the woman, and we therefore know that, believe it or not, our enemy has offspring. And that has been the crux of human history, has been the battle between Satan already knows, the enemy already knows his fate. His head will be crushed, but he is going to bruise the heel. And then the other thing is that at times he has tried to ward off the coming Messiah. He is, one way he has tried to do that is kill off the Messianic line. We saw that in Egypt with the story of Moses, when the Pharaoh issued a decree to kill all the Hebrew baby boys. We saw it after Jesus' birth with Herod and his, although it was, I guess they were trying to close the barn door after the horses got out, but he was attempting. And we saw it all the way in modern day, you know, Nazi Germany, that there continues to be. So I think sometimes, as we see, you know, in the beginning, Satan had to focus on, it's strange, I feel a little strange using the word Satan, because we're assigning this like to one being, and I think we kind of lose the fact that there's a host of beings that are our enemy, that seek our destruction. And but at the beginning, those enemies were focused on mankind. Then as they learned the Messianic line was going to come from Abraham, things were focused on the line of Abraham. And you read all through the Old Testament, all the struggles that Abraham went through. And then we kind of forget that all of that comes to a head with David. And that's where I wanted to start with, when we go back here, and to understand David's throne, which if we understand David's throne, we understand a future throne. And so I kind of blew over this, and I thought it was kind of interesting when I went back and started reading this with some of the other stuff I've been reading. And it says in 2 Samuel chapter 5, I wanted to go through verses 1 and 2 again, because it really establishes something. And it says, then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, behold, we are your bone and your flesh. So if you understand the future throne, basically what to say, Dave, you're one of us. So you have a right to rule over us. You're one of us. Basically, the throne, the earth, was given dominion. Adam was given dominion of the earth. He kind of squandered that as he fell into rebellion. But the person that's going to set that right has to be a human. So that's one of the requirements. Kind of a second requirement, it says, in times past when Saul was king of us, over us, it was you who led us out and brought in Israel. So you showed us who you were. And that is basically the Gospels. Jesus Christ is showing us who he is, what his mission is, and what he was sent here to accomplish. And you remember all throughout, many times he did miracles and he said, don't tell anybody, it's not my time. But then at the triumphal entry, he said, you know, they came to him and said, hey, they're calling you the Messiah, make people stop. And he basically told them, if they didn't say it, I'd make the rock say it. So that is, he was shown, He was showing who he was, which the people, David has presented to the people who he is. He is the leader. He's the one that marched the armies out, had the victories, and the same way Jesus Christ is our leader. It's not our victories. We can't do anything. If you're anything like me, I'm a bumbling, you know, knucklehead and wrong at most things, just out of my wife. And
you agree with you. I'm going to keep that as record. Chris was right once.
So, you know, without him, we can't really do anything. And obviously, without him, we can do no good. And he said that. And then the final thing, and it said, "And the Lord said to you, you shall be the shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be the prince over Israel." So if we expand this in us, when the dove came down, it said, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased." The resurrection proved that God had accepted the sacrifice, and now Jesus can claim that throne. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but I wanted to go back. It was kind of interesting that was, I could kind of find that. You can agree with that or you cannot, but I thought it was kind of interesting that was buried in the throne of David when he takes. And if we get far enough today, the reason I brought that up is because I want to go back. Eventually, God's going to reaffirm this with David, and we're going to see that tied to Gabriel speaking to Mary in the New Testament. Again, the point of this is not to just study a historical book in the Bible and to say, okay, this is what David did. What does that mean? It has to be able to be applicable to us. We have to understand why that's there and what lesson is in that for us. And I think, you know, I think we forget that it's a man on the throne of God, right? That we forget he's fully God, yet fully man. And it's just, you know, I guess I was just reading when John was in Revelation and they presented the scroll and he just cried uncontrollably because he just looked at humanity and what it had become. Lord knows, I mean, we can see what's happening now. I don't know how long the Lord's going to delay his coming, but if we continue on the current trajectory of where humans are headed, you know, it's kind of funny that how, you know, we talk about picture in the books, you know, we were like an amoeba and we learned how to do this and then we learned how to walk and make fire and we're going to become, we're headed to godlike status. When God said, no, I created you with godlike status and you're headed this way. You're not going that way. As much as you think you are, you're not going that way. You're going this way. And you know, so John said, you know, he just cried uncontrollably, and we kind of, and you kind of miss that, you think, because we know Jesus is there, we know Jesus is standing in the background, but at that moment in time, until that lamb that was slain stepped forward to show that he's fully man and able to take that deed, which I believe is the title of the earth, to take dominion over the earth. So I think it's kind of important that we, again, look at some of David. And we're going to, the first couple chapters that we go through the book, David, the human, the man, the guy, the man after God's own heart, he kind of reaches a pinnacle. And then, sad to say, the rest of the book's kind of a hit or miss kind of downhill trajectory. And but again, David is called a man after God's own heart. So I think it's kind of interesting that God seems to look past all the messes. And I was thinking about him back to how the enemy focused. So obviously the enemy knows what's been promised David. And we look at, you know, last week, we kind of go back. We kind of ended where it said, I believe we ended where it said, and David took many concubines from, and we've just learned that every time you read that in the book, that it's a disaster, right? It's like the Titanic's like, there's the iceberg! No good's going to come out of that. But I actually was just dwelling this morning. I was thinking, you know what? I think God had a little bit of fun with that because Satan's going to focus on David and he's going to try to destroy his family. And God has to say, all right, I'm going to give you a train wreck. Figure this out. Everybody's a train wreck. Who do you attack? You know? And out of, you know, the mess, the adultery, the murders and all that, came the next king after David. And it's kind of interesting, if you were Satan, you wouldn't have been figuring on that. You know, you're trying to look for the next good guy, and there really isn't a whole lot of them in the mix. You know, they all got some kind of problem. So I just thought that was kind of interesting, and I wanted to bring that, you know, and out of our lives that are, again, you know, my life can be and has been a train wreck at times. And out of that, the Lord has redeemed many things that I thought were beyond redemption. So so I kind of wanted to backtrack there. And then I think it's kind of interesting that when so David's going to begin taking Jerusalem, and you'll know the Salem means peace, the city of peace, which it has been anything but. And so it's kind of funny, and it says, and the king and his men went to Jerusalem, we'll get down to verse 6, against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and lame will ward you off," thinking David cannot come in here. And it kind of reminds me of, like we said, the Battle of Babel, when the king just, the armies were surrounded, he decided to throw a party because he was just so content in his defenses, and he didn't even know the city had already fallen in reality. So here, David, it says, and nevertheless, it's kind of funny, they boast this, you know, the blind and the lame will ward you off. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. The Bible just goes, they said you couldn't do it. All right, David did it. Let's go on. But it's kind of funny, and then they kind of go back and give you some details. And David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore it is said, the blind and the lame should not come into my house." So we see a kind of an establishment of the future when the temple is built, the blind and the lame are not allowed in the house. And but here it's more of, and if you know anything about the way Jerusalem was built, it's on the side of a hill. Only the north is kind of vulnerable to attack. And so they felt kind of isolated. And there's a water source that's a spring that's inside the city walls. Therefore, that was the worst thing when somebody laid siege and you couldn't get food or water, you weren't going to last very long. So they felt pretty confident. But actually the water, like just like Babylon, their source of water was the weak point, and David went in through that water shaft and took the city. So much for bragging and boasting. So down to verse 13, I think is where we ended. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. So, again, not excusing it, because this is exactly, I need to go back and look. I will add that in here, I promise, next week. I'm going to go back and look in the Old Testament as to the laws of what, it's kind of funny, we always think that, you know, with Saul and what went on with Samuel, and they keep saying, Samuel's very upset when the Israelites want a king, and he takes it personally, and God says, it's not against you, it's against me they're rebelling. But in reality, there had been plans to have a king. God had set forth, Yahweh had set forth in the Old Testament, here's the rules that the kings are going to obey. And one of them was not a whole bunch of concubines. So, yeah, go ahead if you got it.
Or at least part. Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. When you come into the land which the Lord your God has given you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren, you shall set him as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in the book, from the one before the priests and Levites, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren.
The word neither got smudged out of his Bible that day. The word neither shall got smudged out of his Bible that day. So he said, oh, I shall...
Well, he's going to just change it. He says the concubine is not a
lady. What's the scripture in that?
Deuteronomy 17:14-20.
All right, so you can see David, for all men after God's own heart, you know, it's going to become, you know, the greatest king maybe on the history of the planet, but has his shortcomings and is obviously showing that he is a fallen being just like the rest of us. Did we go through this, the battle?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
We actually finished five. Right?
Okay. I wanted to go back.
You flew through it. That's why I need to go back.
Yeah. So I will just pick it up from here. We'll go through it real quick. So verse 17, when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come out and spread in the valley of the Rephaim. That's an interesting name if you want to look into that. I'll pick it up another, but that's something. If you want to do something on your own, look up the valley of Rephaim. The meaning. And David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I certainly will give the Philistines into your hand. Then David came from Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And David said, the Lord has burst through my enemies before me like a bursting flood. Therefore the name of the place shall be called Baal Perazim. And the Philistine left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away, which doesn't go into many details. I'm assuming their idols were probably made of, you know, gold or silver or that, but, you know, obviously this could lead to problems. We've seen, you know, many times throughout the Bible, somebody gets their god carried away, and they're very upset about it, but I think it's kind of interesting when you can carry your god away. But the Philistines came up yet again and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. So here we go, round two. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, You shall not go up, go around to their rear and come against them opposite the balsam trees. And so here's kind of an interesting tactic, that instead of facing them head on like they did the first time, they're going to swing around and come from their rear. And it, usually in the rear is where the king, where all the logistics and all that stuff was hidden behind the front lines. So it's kind of an interesting tactic that's been used throughout history. You can even see it in our own Civil War many times. It was a matter of trying to get to the other army's logistics, their leadership, you know, their supplies. But I think it's interesting in verse 24, and when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourself, for the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines. So I think it's really, really interesting. It goes back to, remember Elijah and his servant? And, you know, he was surrounded. The king kept thought he had a spy in his headquarters, because every movie did, Israel countered it. They had, and he's like, okay, somebody's a spy. And they said, no, it's a prophet, knows what you're doing. So he says, all right, we're going to go kill this guy. So he's in this, you get the feeling he's kind of in this little house out in the middle of nowhere, him and his servant. And the servant gets up and says, oh no, we're surrounded. The army's here. They're going to kill us. And he just like casually says to him, Lord, show him. And he gets his eyes open, and he sees the host of the Lord's army is surrounding that army, and basically you have nothing to fear. So it's kind of interesting not to get too far off topic, that a lot of things in life are perception. And maybe on purpose we're not allowed to perceive things because, I don't know, I'd like to say that it allows us to act on faith when we can't see exactly everything that's going on, and when you can just trust and do that. And how many, you know, time with your kids you were like, you know, don't do that. And they have to just, they don't understand why you're saying don't put the knife in the outlet. But, you know, there's a reason. They don't understand it quite yet. And they have to have a little faith that mom and dad knows that this is going to hurt. So, but yet, and it's kind of interesting if you read about the development of the human eye, how animals can see much better at light, and there's other animals that see higher up. But God picked the largest, our eyes can perceive light in the longest look. We can see the most information, like animals can see at night sometimes, but they can't see in color. So, and then, you know, other animals like eagles can see, but they don't have really good peripheral vision. But they can, you know, focus on something and see it from, you know, a mile in the sky. That God picked the perfect place for our eyes to perceive all the data that our brains can handle. So if he'd have gave us, at times we see in the Bible people get the glimpse of that other realm that is out there that we can't, it's there, it exists. You know, we just don't perceive it. And sometimes we're just meant not to. We have to take that on faith, that if for some reason God wants to show you that realm, he will show it to you. But, you know, most of the time we're probably better off if we don't see it. And
Chris, ultimately Elijah saw it. He said, show him what he doesn't see.
Yeah. So he knew what was there. He was
right, seeing it. Of faith. And that's the New Testament that we walk as not seeing.
Right.
So it's the faith that brings you to the point of seeing things surface.
So it's kind of interesting here, I kind of played this out with our eyes, but in here, there's a realm, there's the same thing works for the frequencies that our ears hear. So right here, God's going to give them a little glimpse into the, not a glimpse, but a little sound into the other realm, that who's going out and really fighting the battle. So, I mean, this doesn't mean that there's not going to be a physical battle. But it shows that there's beings behind the Philistines and their army. And there's beings behind David and his army. And, you know, when God marches out and takes care of that business, then taking care of business in this realm obviously becomes a lot easier. And I think it's kind of interesting that in that realm, you know, we have our senses that God just picked, like, the perfect place for us to be, to hear the most sounds, to hear. And if we could hear, like, higher frequencies, it would confuse our brain waves. And there's really interesting things if you go into, like, our eye perception, our ear perception, and where those frequencies and where those wavelengths are for our eyes, how, you know, God just picked the perfect place to put us for the world that we live in. And kind of interesting, but every once in a while he pulls the curtain back and you get to see into the book of, which, you know, you can look into that, the matter collider in Europe, and, you know, they're basically trying to summon demons. You know, they're trying to crack open the portal to that other realm, and just, You just, like, I guess people are just so deceived, because in my mind I'm thinking, who the heck would want to do that? Yeah. Who's crazy? But these people are like, oh, it's going to be great. It's like, nah, I don't know if you're going to get what you think you're going
to
get.
Trying to crack open something that's open?
Yeah. Well, they're trying to control it. How's that?
Yeah,
which I think there's probably people running around that tried that. All right, so 2 Samuel 6, so we almost made it to where we wanted to be in a half hour. So, David again. What's that?
Great.
Good job.
David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. And remember, what we call the Ark is definitely, it's two things. There's the Ark of the Covenant, and then the cover is where the cherubs are. And the Lord dwells on the lid between the cherubs. That it's two separate kind of entities that are things that are put together, but there are two parts to it. And it's kind of, they carried the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, not Ohio, the sons of Abinadab were driving the new cart with the Ark of God, and Ahio went before the Ark, Uzzah and the Ark. Oh, I'm sorry, that was just the title in the where you're reading through your Bible. Now I'm like Joe Biden just reading off the teleprompter. And David and all the house of Israel were making merry before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. So it's kind of interesting. This is kind of almost like a celebration kind of atmosphere. And when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put his hand on the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the Ark of God. So when you're kind of first reading this, you're kind of like, man, that's a pretty harsh punishment for, you know, I'm trying to do a good deed, you know, the oxen are stumbling, I don't want the Ark to fall. And so I kind of delved into that a little bit. I this was the best thing I could find to kind of look at that situation. First, God had given Moses and Aaron specific instructions about the tent of meeting and the movement of the Ark of the Covenant. After Aaron and his sons had finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, and when the camp was ready to move, the Kohathites are to come and do the carrying, but they must not touch the holy things or they will die. The Kohathites are to carry those things that are in a tent of meetings. No matter how innocently it was done, touching the Ark was a direct violation of God's law and was to result in death. This was the means of preserving the sense of God's holiness and the fear of drawing near to him without appropriate preparation. Notice how David took men with him to collect the Ark, rather than allowing the Levites to bring it to him. This was a great mistake. Since it ought to have never been put upon a cart, old or new, it was to be borne upon men's shoulders and carried by the Levites only, and those of the family of Kohath, using the poles prescribed. Failing to follow God's precise instructions would be seen as not revering God's words when he spoke them through those such as Moses, whom he had appointed. Having an independent attitude that might border on rebellion, and seeing and acting on this thing from a worldly rather than a spiritual perspective or disobedience. Second, the Ark stayed for a period of time at Abinadab's house, where his sons, Uzzah and Ahio, may have well become accustomed to his presence. There's an old saying, familiarity breeds contempt, that could apply in this case. Uzzah, having been around the Ark in his own home, could very likely forget the holiness that it represented. There are times when we, too, fail to recognize the holiness of God, becoming too familiar with him with an irreverent attitude. Third, the account tells us that the oxen stumbled. The cart didn't fall, and neither did the Ark. Just as the boat carrying Jesus and the disciples rocked fiercely in the storm, though it wasn't necessarily in danger sinking, and yet just as with the disciples who failed to put their faith in their master, Uzzah, for a moment, felt it was his responsibility to save the integrity of God and that our Almighty God somehow needed Uzzah's assistance. He presumed that without his intervention, God's presence would be dealt a blow. As Job asked, can you fathom the mysteries of God? His greatness no one can fathom. His understanding no one can fathom. Moses lost his right to enter the promised land because he felt his intervention was needed when he struck the rock instead of speaking to it as God has commanded him. We need to listen carefully to what God has to say to us and in obedience strive to do all he commands. Yes, God is loving and merciful, but he is also holy and he defends his holiness with his power. And affronts to his holiness sometimes bring about his holy wrath. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. That's in Hebrews. Something in God's presence at the Ark of the Covenant seems to be lost in the church today. In the time of Moses, the people knew the awesomeness of God's absolute holiness. They had witnessed a great miracle with the Ark. It was with them. They respected God's in ways. Respected that God's ways and thought are much higher than ours. In truth, the more we bring God down to our worldly way of thinking and reasoning, the further away he will seem to us. Those who do not draw near to God and have him draw near to them are those who approach him in reverence and holy fear. Uzzah forgot that lesson, and the consequences were tragic. So I thought that was a pretty good explanation, because the first reading of that, you're like, wow, you know, he's doing a good thing. He's keeping the ark from falling. But, you know, David had made a mistake in how he was even approaching this. And it's kind of interesting how he attempts to rectify this. It's kind of...
Can I share one thing?
Yeah.
It's very important to remember, just because somebody in charge tells you to do something, listen to the Lord. Because David's action, although a desire to bring God's presence to him, caused other people to lose their lives by not following the way.
Agreed. And we kind of say, I kind of said, that's kind of a pattern in David's life that, you know, you saw it with the priest when all the priests were killed because David had told a lie. And, you know, you see it with Uriah the Hittite when he had him killed because
he wouldn't sleep with his wife.
Well, because he already, so yeah,
no,
he wouldn't sleep with his wife, right. So other people, you know, it's definitely a pattern in David's life that, you know, we don't realize. I don't know, remember long, I've always had this theory about life that you go through life, I don't know if any of you have ever been on a boat, but your life has a boat wake, if you will. And you go through those piers in life, and there's places that says, go 6 miles an hour, watch your wake. And you always see some knucklehead, you know, zooming through there. He's got this 3-foot wake, and people's boats are being. And that's how we can go through life. We can go through life full speed, and we're slamming everybody up against the piers, and but we're getting done what we think, and sometimes what we think God needs to get done. We don't realize that behind us, we're just, you know, nothing but devastation and, you know, all that. And there's sometimes you just need to.
I'm sorry, but right before that, God just said, I'm with you. And David knew that God raised him up to be king. So now he's trying to bring in the...
Right, now he's...
Now he's trying to bring in the artist.
Now he's trying to show that,
right,
you know. And it's kind of interesting here because it says, and David was angry because the Lord had burst forth against Uzzah. Therefore, that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? So I looked up the place name, meaning breach, and it means the Perez Uzzah, means the breach of Uzzah, and where the anger of the Lord broke out against Uzzah, who touched the ark to steady it. The site is perhaps that of Kibar El Uz, which is about 2 miles east of Kirath Jearim. Just, I don't know, I thought I'd look it up. So David was not willing to take the Lord, the ark of the Lord, into the city of David, but David took it aside to the house of Obedium, the Gittite. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obedium, Edom, and Gittite 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obedium and all his house. So it's kind of, you know, David's got this mess on his hands where he didn't listen and didn't do exactly what he did. But every time he pulls over to the side of the road and tries to straighten things out, people get blessed there. And it was told King of David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God. So David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. And those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken six steps. He sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. So you can imagine how long it took him to get there if every six steps he stopped and had a sacrifice. So here he went from one extreme, just callously moving to the ultimate in obedience. So, and it's kind of funny how we kind of do that in our lives, you know. Many times I've had a spiritual spanking, and then, you know, I get up a half hour early and think I'm going to read a little bit more today because, you know, that's what's going to get me back in the, you know, good graces. And so it's interesting here. It says, David, wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the ark, before the Lord with all his might. So I didn't find anything really about it, but it's kind of interesting that the ephod is something that a priest wears, but I guess a linen one, it was just whatever he wore, kind of maybe to symbolize whatever, but it doesn't seem to cause a problem. And while he and all Israel were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sounds of trumpet, as the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul watched from a window, and when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. So, you know, she attributes it kind of to something else we're going to see, but it just, you get the feeling that she's jealous of him celebrating with his God, and just to have that hatred in your heart is just a very, very dark thing, and it's going to cost her mightily. So they brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it, and David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women, and all the people went to their homes. So David, so here it's been this really, really great experience, and kind of laugh, you know, you've been to work, you've had a good day at work, you know, things went well, the boss gave you a little pat on the back and everything, but you don't know what's waiting for you at home. The, you know, the kids have been bad all day, and things are going. But it says, when David returned home to bless his household, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of the servants as any vulgar fellow would. So she's trying to pop his balloon and, you know, let the air out.
Hey, Magic Mike, that's where you...
So, and David said to Michal, it was before the Lord who chose me above your father. So that's a pretty harsh, David pulls no punches right there, and above all his house, to appoint me as prince over Israel and the people of the Lord, and I will make merry before the Lord. So, and I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in your eyes. But by the female servants of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor. So he basically blasts her with both barrels and says, you know, pick me instead of your dad. You're probably kind of mad about that. You know, none of your brothers are here. Kind of mad about that. And basically, I'm doing it in front of the Lord, and he doesn't seem to mind, and you just mind your own business.
It's been 7 years or so, or more, since the card's been gone, because they lost it the day her dad died.
Yep. So Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. So that pretty much, obviously we know in that culture, that was a pretty big, you know, and you see David has like 50 kids, and it might have to be really kind of tough on her to be in this, you know, in the with the king, and everybody's running around with, you know, his kids and stuff, and you got nothing. So maybe she should have. Do you want to press on a little bit, or are we good there? Do you want to? About time? We're good? Comments, questions? Anybody? Sorry, we didn't. We could have went a little further if I hadn't went back, but I thought that was a pretty important reason to go back and kind of discuss some of that stuff that we blew through. Hopefully, I'm kind of getting a little more used to my schedule, and I'll be able to. That's kind of funny because I was a little backed up yesterday, and I was really counting on yesterday being a big morning when I kind of sit down and redo this, and I had me and Karen had our grandkids, so
you don't know.
Yeah. But it worked. Yeah, I did have a big morning, but little Lucy laid down, took a nap, and I had a little bit of time, so it worked out good.
Chris, I was thinking when you were talking about perception and how they saw certain things in the battle and others didn't, I was thinking that if you've ever seen that movie or that documentary about the Six-Day War miracles, that where Israel like only had like six people there, but the other side, they perceived that it was like 100 or something, and of course they ran. So I was thinking, you know, how God has done that. And then I was thinking about like the news today, which I'm trying not to, you know, read a lot of what's going on. But, you know, I saw today this where, you know, but like in this country, both the left and the right are on to our president. Nobody likes what he's doing. And so he's like, he didn't know what to do. And it's kind of like God protecting Israel again, as he usually does, because nobody knows, you know, nobody who doesn't know knows what the world is thinking right now. So, and everybody's wrong.